Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Alice Bryant and Pete Musto. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, the cost of living in the United States is going up, notes writer Alyssa Quart. As reported in the New York Post, Quart points to the cost of housing, education, health care, and child care in particular. At the same time, a new study found that half of Americans born in the 1980s are falling behind their parents economically. The study is a project of researchers at Stanford University, Harvard University, and the University of California, Berkeley. Their report is called The Fading American Dream. Together, these findings show that many younger adults are experiencing downward mobility. In other words, they are not doing as well, either socially or economically, as their parents were at the same age. The idea of downward mobility is especially troubling for Americans, writes Robert Samuelson in the Washington Post. He says most U.S. citizens believe that, over time, the amount of money they earn will rise and life will get easier. And for some, that belief has come true. In the Fading American Dream study, researchers found that 90% of Americans born in the 1940s grew up to earn more than their parents. That percentage is so high, say the researchers, partly because of historical events. In the 1930s, the U.S. economy was in a severe depression, and most people's earnings went down. But in the 1950s, the economy expanded, and most people's incomes went up. As a result, almost all Americans born in the 1940s experienced upward mobility. But among members of this generation, only about 60% of their children earned more money than they did. And only 50% of children born in the following 10 years were earning more than their parents at the same age. In other words, Americans' ease of living is going down. In technical terms, the economists write, absolute mobility has fallen sharply over the past 50 years. Alyssa Quart wrote a book about the financial difficulties of everyday Americans. It is called Squeezed: Why Our Families Can't Afford America. In her book, Quart tells about teachers who are struggling to pay for housing, childcare, and other regular costs. One high school teacher said he drives for ride-sharing service Uber at night to earn more money. He corrects students' papers between riders. Another man, a college professor, only earns enough to pay for simple food, such as pasta and potatoes, for his children. A different college professor turned to government assistance to feed her child and pay for a doctor. Quart says even lawyers increasingly cannot earn an income that enables them to meet their needs. The problem of decreasing incomes in their field is made worse by debt they may have from law school. Court and the economists who studied these issues say many things have led to lower incomes and downward mobility. The economic recession of 2007 to 2009 is partly to blame, they say. Modern technology also plays a part. Court says robots threaten to reduce the earnings of healthcare workers, truckers, reporters, and people who work at supermarkets, drugstores, and tax preparation services.
People who request asylum after entering the United States illegally are much more likely to be denied than approved. That information comes from the U.S. Department of Justice. Out of around 120 asylum requests by people who entered the country illegally in 2017, only about 7,000 were approved. That makes Sergio very lucky. Sergio is a 64-year-old man from Mexico who asked to only be known by his first name. In Spanish, he told VOA his reasoning for coming to the U.S. I came to the United States in 1992 because there was not a lot of work down there, he said. But under the zero-tolerance policy of the administration of President Donald Trump, Sergio was targeted for deportation. That happened after he was arrested for drunkenness in May of last year. Asylum requests that are made after an illegal entry are called defensive asylum requests. They are handled by the Department of Justice. Asylum requests made by people who came to the U.S. legally are called affirmative asylum requests. They are handled by U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services, or USCIS. The chances of being approved for defensive asylum got a little better in the first half of 2018. Requests fell to less than 86,000, but approvals remained around 7,000. The approval rate remains extremely low. Even for affirmative asylum requests in 2016, only 10% of more than 115,000 were approved. Sergio was moved to a jail in Orange County near Los Angeles, where he says a guard insulted him early in his 9 months there. Sergio said the guard accused him of being disrespectful and reminded him that he was a prisoner. I said, "No, I'm not a prisoner," Sergio answered. "I'm in detention for immigration. I haven't committed any crimes." He says his relationship with the guards got worse from there. Joel Frost Tift works for the Esperanza Immigrant Rights Project of Catholic Charities. He is Sergio's lawyer and requested asylum for him. He said that Sergio suffered from mental illness. A judge agreed with the lawyer that Sergio would not receive good care if he were sent back to Mexico. The judge approved asylum for Sergio on February 15th. But, Frost Tift said, because the judge did not make a full written or spoken statement, there is no way to know his reasoning. Some judges have found that conditions in mental health institutions cause people to face a reasonable possibility
of persecution, he said, and in some cases, even that they are more likely than not to be tortured. Petitioners for asylum must prove they have a reasonable fear of persecution in their home country. The United Nations defines reasonable fear as at least a 10% chance of persecution. Asylum seekers must also officially request asylum within a year of their arrival in the U.S. Sergio did not do that. I'm Alice Bryant.
Wild animals are known to listen to each other for warnings that predators are near. Some birds, for example, flee when neighbors make a loud noise to announce a snake's presence. The fairy wren is a small Australian songbird. It is not born knowing the languages of other birds. But recent research says it can learn the meaning of a few important sounds. Andrew Radford is a biologist at the University of Bristol in England and co-writer of the new report published in early August in the journal Current Biology. He told the Associated Press, "We knew before that some animals can translate the meanings of other species' foreign languages, but we did not know how that language learning came about." Birds have several ways of learning life skills. Some knowledge is genetically passed by their parents, and some comes from direct experience with the world. But Radford and other scientists are exploring a third kind of knowledge, information from peers. Radford and researchers at the Australian National University carried out the study in the country's National Botanic Gardens in Canberra. They attached to their bodies specially designed sound-producing equipment called tweeter speakers. They wanted to see if fairy wrens would react to sounds of other birds even if they could not see them. The scientists first played the birds two recorded sounds that they likely had never heard before. One was a warning cry of an allopatric chestnut-rumped thornbill, a bird not native to Australia. The other was a computer-generated bird sound called buzz. When the 16 fairy wrens in the study first heard the sounds, they had no special reaction. The scientists then tried to train half the birds to recognize the thornbill's cry as a warning sound. They tried to train the other half of the birds to recognize the computer-generated buzz as a warning call. They did so by playing the sounds in addition to other noises that the birds already knew as warnings. These included the fairy wren's own threat call. After 3 days, the scientists tested what the birds had learned, and their students passed the test. The fairy wrens trained with the thornbill's cry fled when they heard it. The group trained with the buzz fled when they heard that sound. Neither group reacted to the sound taught to the other. 12 of the 16 birds fled every time the researchers played their given sound. The other 4 birds fled at 2/3 or more of the playbacks. Christopher Templeton is a biologist at Pacific University in Forest Grove, Oregon, who was not involved in the study. "Until this study, we had limited knowledge about how an animal learns what calls from other species actually mean," Templeton said. "What this new study does is remove the predator entirely, It shows that these birds can learn to associate new sounds with danger without having to learn them through trial and error, he added. Andrew Radford of the University of Bristol noted that the ability to learn to link sounds with meaning makes biological sense. If you can only learn in the presence of a predator, that's quite dangerous, he said. I'm Pete Musto.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Steve Ember. Today we tell about the movement for civil rights for Black Americans. The day is August 28, 1963. More than 250,000 people are gathered in Washington. Black and white, young and old, they demand equal treatment for Black Americans. The nation's most famous civil rights leader, the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr., is speaking.
I am happy to join with you today in what will go down in history as the greatest demonstration for freedom in the history of our nation.
Early in its history, Black Africans were brought to America as slaves. They were bought and sold like animals. By the time of America's Civil War in the 1860s, many had been freed by their owners. Many, however, still worked as slaves on the plantations or large farms of the South. By the end of the war, slavery had been declared unconstitutional. But that was only the first step in the struggle for equality. Most people of color could not get good jobs. They could not get good housing. They had far less chance of a good education than white Americans. For about 100 years, blacks made slow gains. Widespread activism for civil rights did not really begin until after World War II. During the war, Black Americans earned respect as members of the armed forces. When they came home, many demanded that their civil rights be respected too. An organization, the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, led the way. In 1951, the organization sent its lawyers to help a man in the city of Topeka, Kansas. The man, Oliver Brown, and 12 others had brought legal action against the city. They wanted to end racial separation in their children's schools. That policy was known as segregation. At that time, 2 of every 5 public schools in America had all-white students or all-black students. The law said all public schools must be equal, but they were not. Schools for white children were almost always better than schools for black children. The situation was worst in southern states. The case against the city of Topeka, Brown versus the Board of Education, was finally settled by the nation's highest court. In 1954, the Supreme Court ruled that separate schools for black children were not equal to schools for white children. The next year, it said public schools must accept children of all races as quickly as possible. In September 1957, a black girl attempted to enter an all-white school in the city of Little Rock, Arkansas. An angry crowd shouted at her. State guards blocked her way. The guards had been sent by the state governor, Orville Faubus. After 3 weeks, a federal court ordered Governor Faubus to remove the guards. The girl, Elizabeth Eckford, and other black students were able to enter the school. After 1 day, however, riots forced the black students to leave. President Dwight Eisenhower ordered federal troops to Little Rock. They helped black students get into the white school safely. However, angry white citizens closed all the city's public schools. The schools stayed closed for 2 years. In 1962, a black student named James Meredith sought to attend the University of Mississippi. School officials refused. John F. Kennedy, the president at that time, sent federal law officers to help him. James Meredith became the first black person to graduate from the University of Mississippi. In addition to fighting for equal treatment in education, black Americans fought for equal treatment in housing and transportation. In many cities of the South, blacks were forced to sit in the back of buses. In 1955, a black woman named Rosa Parks got on a bus in the city of Montgomery, Alabama. She sat in the back. The bus became crowded. There were no more seats for white people. So the bus driver ordered Mrs. Parks to stand and give her seat to a white person. She refused. Her feet were tired after a long day at work. Rosa Parks was arrested.
For a number of years, the Negro passengers on the city bus lines of Montgomery have been humiliated, intimidated, and faced threats on this bus line.
The Reverend Martin Luther King organized the black citizens of Montgomery. They were the major users of the bus system. They decided to stop using the buses.
At present, we are in the midst of a protest, the Negro citizens of Montgomery, representing some 44% of the population. 90% at least of the regular Negro bus passengers are staying off the buses, and we plan to continue until something is done.
The boycott lasted a little more than a year. It seriously affected the earnings of the bus company. In the end, racial separation on the buses in Montgomery was declared illegal. Rosa Parks' tired feet had helped win black Americans another victory in their struggle for equal rights. And the victory had been won without violence. The Reverend King was following the teachings of former Indian leader Mohandas Gandhi. Gandhi urged his followers to reach their political goals without violence. One of the major tools of nonviolence in the civil rights struggle in America was the sit-in. In a sit-in, protesters entered a store or public eating place. They quietly asked to be served. Sometimes they were arrested. Sometimes they remained until the business closed, but they were not served. Some went hours without food or water.
Buses are coming. Oh, yeah.
Another kind of protest was the Freedom Ride. This involved buses that traveled through states from the north to the south. On freedom rides, blacks and whites sat together to make it difficult for officials to enforce racial separation laws on the buses. Many freedom rides and much violence took place in the summer of 1964. Sometimes the Freedom Riders were arrested. Sometimes angry crowds of whites beat the Freedom Riders. Perhaps the most dangerous part of the civil rights movement was the campaign to win voting rights for black Americans. The 15th Amendment to the Constitution said a citizen could not be denied the right to vote because of race or color. Several southern states, however, passed laws to try to deny voting rights to blacks for other reasons. Martin Luther King and his supporters demanded new legislation to guarantee the right to vote. They held protests in the state of Alabama. In the city of Birmingham, the chief law officer ordered his men to fight the protesters with high-pressure water hoses and fierce dogs. People throughout the country watched the demonstration on television. The sight of people, including children, being beaten by policemen and bitten by dogs, awakened many citizens to the civil rights struggle. Federal negotiators reached a compromise. The compromise was, in fact, a victory for the protesters. They promised to stop their demonstrations. In exchange, they would be permitted to vote.
The Freedom Train!
President Lyndon Johnson signed a major civil rights bill in 1964. Yet, violence continued in some places. Three civil rights workers were murdered in Mississippi. One was murdered in Alabama. Martin Luther King kept working toward the goal of equal rights. On April 4, 1968, he died working toward that goal. King was shot to death in Memphis, Tennessee. He had gone there to support a strike by waste collection workers.
Dr. King was standing on the balcony of a second-floor hotel room tonight when, according to a companion, a shot was fired from across the street. In the friend's words, the bullet exploded in his face.
CBS newsman Walter Cronkite.
Police, who have been keeping a close watch over the Nobel Peace Prize winner because of Memphis' turbulent racial situation, were on the scene almost immediately. They rushed the 39-year-old Negro leader to a hospital where he died of a bullet wound in the neck.
A white man, James Earl Ray, was tried and found guilty of the crime. A wave of unrest followed the murder of Martin Luther King Jr. Blacks in more than 100 cities in America rioted. In some cities, areas affected by the riots were not rebuilt for many years. The movement for civil rights for black Americans continued, but it became increasingly violent. The struggle produced angry, bitter memories. Yet it also produced some of the greatest words spoken in American history.
When we allow freedom to ring, when we let it ring from every village and every hamlet, from every state and every city, we will be able to speed up that day when all of God's children, black men and white men, Jews and Gentiles, Protestants and Catholics, will be able to join hands and sing in the words of the old Negro spiritual, free at last, free at last. Thank God Almighty, we are free at last.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.